This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up, Hartford's mayor takes his re-election campaign to the streets after losing the party's endorsement to a relative newcomer, and race becomes an issue in the capital city. But first, a healthy dose of national political conversation in our weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse. Last week, we focused on municipal races. Today, it's the race for president, which has its first real event of the 2016 race coming up on August 6th as a group of 250 Republican candidates for president face off in a Thunderdome-style debate on Fox. Actually, it's supposed to be a group of 10 debating that night, whittled from the unwieldy 16-person field. But yesterday, Fox announced that it was actually making the event a doubleheader with an under-ticket debate at 5 p.m. That's our first topic. You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, wnpr.org/where we live. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Joining us, as always, is Colin McEnroe. He's the host of The Colin McEnroe Show, heard here at 1 on WNPR. Hello, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Joining us also is Kalila Brown-Dean. She's Associate Professor of Political Science at Quinnipiac University. Hello there, Kalila. Welcome back.
Thanks, John.
And Bill Curry, our political analyst and a columnist for Salon.com. Hello once again, Bill.
Morning, sir.
So first thing, before we get to some of the intemperate things that we've been hearing from Republican presidential candidates, I want to talk a little bit about this debate in the field, Colin. There's a lot of jokes that can be made about 16 people in the field or a 10-person debate or an under-ticket debate and all this. I mean, I suppose it's a pretty good thing that we've got some people to listen to. We're going to get to what they're saying in just a couple minutes. But, I mean, what do you make of 16 Republicans vying for the presidential nomination at this point in the race?
Well, I think in some ways it is indicative of the fact that the Republicans nationally have a pretty strong bench. I mean, some of the people on their bench are pretty goofy. But, I mean, they do have a strong bench. They can field a group of candidates that's more interesting and more potent and more plausible, for at least in terms of competing for the nomination, than the Democrats have. I mean, if Hillary Clinton doesn't show up for these forums, you've got Martin O'Malley and Bernie Sanders kind of sitting around there looking kind of lonely. And so, I mean, and this doesn't even really include all of the other people like Rob Portman and people like that who could have been part of this conversation. And so I think what you're seeing partly anyway is a bunch of young post-Reagan Republicans, people who, as young people, were very inspired and inflamed by, I mean, this isn't true of all of them, but by Ronald Reagan, and who've kind of gone forward to launch these political careers. I mean, this should not be mistaken for my enthusiasm for them as candidates, but I don't think the Democrats have the same thing. Maybe in 10 years there'll be sort of this Bill Clinton wave, of young, vital Democratic politicians who can vie for the presidency, but I don't see it right now.
What's interesting, though, too, is when we did our program recently on the loneliness of the Black Republican, it is somewhat noteworthy, Colin, that of the 16, there's one Black candidate, a man, Ben Carson, and there's one woman, Carly Fiorina. And when you look at the Republican Party as a whole, it's almost like that feels about right. Like they got one woman to represent them, one Black candidate to represent them, and
Marco,
all the rest are white guys.
Marco Rubio, you might as well throw him in, and they got a Latino candidate too.
And they have a Latino candidate, but in essence, the party and its candidates looks an awful lot like the message that the Republican Party has been sending for quite some time. And maybe that's part of what needs to change in that next wave.
Yeah, I mean, it's mostly a whole bunch of white guys. And so, yeah, the people that you're talking about, you know that whale that, like, makes noises at 52 hertz or something, and, like, the other whales can't hear it? You know, it's like the loneliest whale in the world. That's sort of the role of the minority person within the Republican presidential field. But on the other hand, though, I mean, they have to – they're not going to win elections because, as Bill said a long time ago, they're not just on the wrong side of history. They're on the wrong side of demographics. But at least they've got kind of a lively contest going here, and that's usually pretty good for parties. And the Democrats don't have a lively contest going.
Yeah, so the Republicans have a lively contest. What do you make of the contest right now, Kalila?
You know, I hear a lot of people complaining that there are too many people at this point, but I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I think it's good to have options. Whether there's a lot of difference between these options, we'll see in the debates. But I think we should also remember that you have Ted Cruz running. You have Bobby Jindal running. And so you see this effort on the part of the Republican Party to at least be symbolically representative of the country. And when we look on the Democratic side, we don't see that same level of robust change there. So this debate will be interesting to see, well, who's on the undercard and does that really matter? Or will Donald Trump continue to dominate the American perception of who's really running in this race.
When you say undercard, are you referring to, like, now they have like this, you know, this kid's table, you know, the children's table, like at 5 o'clock?
Well,
that's going to be kind of humiliating, right?
I keep wondering, like, who's the Ronda Rousey yeah. in this debate, right? Who is the contender and how do you decide? And will it be based on how people perform in this debate? You have people running that most Americans have never heard of. But that is also, I think, indicative of American politics. Money gets the vote.
I will say, and I apologize for this, as I was talking about the overwhelming whiteness of the candidates, I had neglected to remember that Bobby Jindal was running. And I think a lot of Americans have neglected to remember that Bobby Jindal is running. He is going to be at that kids' table. Mm-hmm. He is not polling very well right now. So what do you make of all this, Bill? I mean, we've got this huge group. We're going to talk about some of the things that they've been saying to differentiate themselves in just a moment. But what do you make of Collins' notion that maybe a robust, large group of Republicans with a deep bench is something that bodes well for the party in some way?
But I agree with what Colin said. I'll point out two things, though. The first is that people talk a lot about how Donald Trump is sucking all the oxygen out of the room, but there is no political room with enough oxygen for 16 people. So even if he weren't there, there's not enough attention to go around. For most of these people, the size of this field, it may be a good thing for us, maybe a good thing for politics, but the candidates all think it's a bad thing. Mm-hmm. And the idea that you can have a 1 or 2 hour televised debate with even 10 people in it. I was in a 4-person gubernatorial debate a long, long time ago. And, you know, between the intermissions and the moderator and the time that people take to ask the questions, there's so little time. I can't imagine what a 10-person debate is going to look like. I think this is the most crowded presidential field in the history of the country. I've looked into it pretty well now. And I can't find a race in which there was anything like this.
Well, if you want a sense of what it might be like on stage on August 6th on Fox, whether at 9 o'clock or at 5 o'clock, maybe you could just listen to some of what the candidates have been saying. I mean, we've heard Donald Trump talk about Mexicans coming over illegally and calling them rapists. He then followed up by talking about John McCain and questioning his war hero status. We heard in our billboard Ted Cruz essentially saying that the Iran deal was a type of jihadi move by the Obama administration. And then there was this from Mike Huckabee.
This president's foreign policy is the most feckless in American history. He's so naive, he would trust the Iranians and he would take the Israelis and basically march them to the door of the oven. This is the most hideous thing. This Iran deal should be rejected by both Democrats and Republicans in Congress and to the American people. I think we forget that the Iranians have never kept a deal in 36 years under the Ayatollah. There's no reason to think that they'll suddenly start doing it. I read the entire thing. We gave away the whole farm.
So Mike Huckabee making a point about the Iran nuclear deal. In the middle of that are the key words there that he believed that this deal would take the Israelis and march them to the door of the oven, something that actually he hasn't come back and said, I misspoke. I'm sorry. I didn't mean that. He's actually kind of Trump-like doubled down on this, Bill.
And let me just – I'm shocked at the last few weeks. I'm not surprised, just shocked. There was a time not long ago when to call all Mexican or most Mexican immigrants rapists, or to accuse the president of the United States of Nazi-like tendencies, or to question the bona fides of a war hero like John McCain, would have run you out of not just politics but the public sphere. It would have been enough in itself. And you've noticed how often in the last few weeks the press has thought that was about to happen to someone, has thought that this was so outrageous, so revolting, such disgusting, toxic sludge that surely the person was about to pay a price. And every time within the Republican Party, the favorabilities of the person in question, Huckabee's been rising. Trump has been rising. Each one of these, they're now in this contest to see who can be the most outrageous. Their base is so angry and so irrational that the contest to get in the debates and to peep your head above this crowd we talked about is simply one of who can say the most horrible, wretched things. It's an extraordinarily depressing thing to watch.
Kalala?
Well, it's depressing, but it's also very concerning that it works, that in our politics now seems to be about a race to the bottom, and it is resonating with particular segments of the American population, people who are engaged and people who vote and people who contribute to elections. So that when you can make a comment that is so disrespectful, not just of the president, but really of Jewish Americans, the descendants, survivors of the Holocaust, to say that and to not be checked by it. So it is a problem for Republican candidates to do it. It is a problem for the Democratic Party not to hold people accountable and for everyday Americans not to say this absence of civility goes against every value that we say we're fighting for.
Let me just say a couple of quick things about the Huckabee thing. First of all, he was actually rebuked on Facebook by the Israeli transport member who is a Likud party transport minister who is a Likud party member. On the other hand, I mean, Netanyahu in April compared Iran to the Nazis. I mean, Huckabee doesn't have a monopoly on this kind of rhetoric. But more to the point of what Bill and Kalila are saying, we're at kind of a long tail point in politics right now. It's the summer of the year before the election. So when people respond positively to, say, Donald Trump in a poll question, they're not really picturing him being sworn in as president of the United States. What they're saying is, you know, well, I'm kind of enjoying that, or that I've thought that thing too, or whatever. They're sort of reacting at that level. And the other thing to remember, of course, is when I say long tail, you don't have to. If you get 18%, you're doing great, right? If you at this point, at 18%, you're killing it. You know, well, 18% is not enough to win anything in an election. It's great if you're a toothpaste brand. If you get 18% of the market, you're probably a pretty successful toothpaste brand. It doesn't work in politics. So the fact that somebody's got 12 or 18 or something like that right now is a little misleading at this point.
But eventually this gets to a general election. And after this many months, whoever emerges on the Republican side has to deal with this being part of the dialogue leading up to this point, Kalila. And that's just the truth. Whether or not that person who ends up as the nominee is one of the people who makes these outrageous statements, or whether or not this is someone who eventually rebukes these outrageous statements, you're still dealing with the baggage of this has been the process
at
this point.
It sets the tone. So I don't want us to underestimate the importance of primary elections in this country, whether we're talking about at the national level or at local and state. It really sets the tone. It sets an agenda for the American people to think, well, these are the issues that I should be thinking about. And if I'm thinking about immigration, well, I really need to focus on Mexico, not thinking about undocumented workers coming from other countries like Ireland. And to Colin's point, public opinion is volatile. So Wes Clark was up for a good 3 weeks in 2004 during the Democratic primary. We know that that did not last very long. But it is setting the tone for what the American people care about and what the policy preferences are. So the candidates and the general have to be held accountable, but we'll continue this theme.
I agree. I would just say with both you guys, but I, you know, that it was the transport minister of Israel who was left to say we thank Mike for his support, but we disagree about this, and fairly tender rebuke. I thought was pretty low key response. Mm-hmm. That the Likud coalition hired a Republican political operative to be the ambassador to the United States and arranged a state visit with the Speaker of the House rather than the President continues to bother me at a very deep level. And I couldn't agree more. The kinds of things Netanyahu has said are horrible. Something's happened here. And again, there is this kind of – there is this phenomenon of the embattled white male in America who sees himself as the victim, who feels displaced by people of color, by women – who has seen the kinds of jobs with which his gender is identified deteriorate and pay less. There is, over nearly a half century now, there is this anger. There is this quantifiable anger. We know the roots of it. And I don't think Donald Trump is ever going to get nominated for anything, for any public office in his life, let alone President of the United States. But to use those words in the way that he did and continues to do, and be rising to a quarter of the support of a major political party, it's not a good sign. I'm rattled by it. To find out that our politics is even more coarse and hateful than we thought it was just a few weeks ago, I find alarming.
I will say, and we're talking in the wheelhouse today, our weekly news roundtable with Bill Curry, Kalila Brown, Dean of Quinnipiac University, and our own Colin McElroy. We're talking a bit about national politics to start off the program. Actually, a few local connections to this race. I think it's fair to say, Colin, that a few of the candidates that are going to be in that the 9 o'clock debate, the top debate, are Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin, and Marco Rubio, who you mentioned earlier. Presidential candidate Marco Rubio, as of today, has tapped Connecticut's former Republican Party head Jerry Labriola Jr. to be the chairman of his political operation in the state. That's according to a report in the Connecticut Post. Labriola was the first state chair in the nation to personally endorse Rubio. So Jerry Labriola goes from running the state Republican Party to now running the campaign in the state for Marco Rubio.
Don't make me say something mean.
I was just offering you the forum if you wanted to say something nice.
Look, this is all about fundraising. That's the only thing that anybody running for president cares about Connecticut from either party. So I don't know if Jerry can walk him up to the right doors and get him that kind of money. That's great. I mean, Jerry was not a great political tactician, you know, but that's – it doesn't really matter, really. I mean, the whole question is what kind of fundraisers can you get access to? What kind of money can you squeeze out of this lemon? So, I mean, he may be pretty good at that, and he's visible. He's not a terrible choice.
Connecticut is the big lemon here, I suppose, that they will continue to squeeze. Neil Vigdor from the Hearst, Connecticut, is reporting from Greenwich, where Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker is right now holding a fundraiser and VIP reception for campaign bundlers. Not a big surprise. And Colin is, of course, right, Kalila, that all we're going to see of Republican and Democratic candidates in Connecticut really is people coming here to try to raise money. Should we be seeing more than that, or is that really what we're going to expect as part of our involvement in the 2016 presidential race?
That's what we should expect, particularly since we don't have any big state-level contests where they could come and offer some support down ticket. But if you look at the issues that Connecticut has been grappling with over the last 3 to 5 years, these are issues of national importance, whether it's the minimum wage, whether it's marriage equality, it's violence, it's immigration. So Connecticut has a lot to offer in terms of policy, but being a competitive state, definitely not.
Here's something else, though, that Neil Vigdor reported this week, that it turns out, Bill, that there's actually a series of these kind of meet and greets, Bernie Sanders meetups, maybe building off of some of the folks that that Ned Lamont energized back in 2006. There's small pockets of liberal Connecticut residents who want to throw the support behind Bernie Sanders. This might not be a fundraising thing. This might be a little bit more of a grassroots thing. Do you see Bernie support rising in Connecticut?
It matters. It matters more than people think it does, these kinds of meetings, that kind of organization. This is what Saul Alinsky built, the farm workers movement and the stockyards movement in Chicago. The incredible importance of face-to-face human contact at a grassroots organizing level, particularly in primaries like this. Trump is up at 24%, not because he spent a penny. All this volatility in the polls, and much of it right to the end, has, especially the presidential race, money is the most overrated factor in presidential politics. It's the one thing they care about. I agree with Colin. If you're a voter and you'd like to meet a Republican or Democratic candidate for president, it's like the old Steve Martin routine. You know, first get $1 million, you know, and then you can meet as many of them as you'd like, and they'll call you. They'll ask how your dog's doing. They'll know all your children's birthdays. And otherwise, you can forget ever getting to ask them a question about immigration or race or income inequality. That's the way this system works now, no question. But at the same time, the fact that Bernie Sanders leads everybody in attendance at events, in the number of people contributing, both all candidates in both parties, Sanders is ahead of. I think it matters. I don't pretend to be like, you know, Nostradamus, and predicting who will win is really, really hard. Okay?
Jimmy the Greek, I was
thinking. That's right, Jimmy the Greek. Either one of them guys. I don't know. But I do know that those kinds of things end up so often turning out to mean more than the early polls did. Again, I'm not predicting that Bernie Sanders will be a nominee either, but that the Democratic Party is about to have a more intellectually interesting, because it's the only debate that's not insane right now, that's civil, substantive, and at least pertinent, and that there's more of a ferment going on. The Republicans have so many candidates in part because their far right can actually sustain 5 or 6 candidates for a year. That's amazing. Our more feeble left has a hard time doing one. But right now it's doing that. The ferment among the Democrats over the next few months may end up being the more interesting and the more important and even the more historic.
Colin, do you have a quick thought on that? Because we haven't talked very much about Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, how that plays in Connecticut and how it actually plays nationally. It's almost the polar opposite of the 16-person crazy debate that we're talking about with Republicans. We're talking about really two poles of the Democratic Party here.
Yeah, I mean, we have sort of a Goldilocks problem here, right? I mean, they've got too many and the other side's got too few. And you'd sort of like to see – I mean, this would be a lot more interesting if, I don't know, Joe Biden and Al Gore and somebody else were – I mean, it would be, I think, a little bit more of a substantive conversation. I mean, look, if the primary were held tomorrow, I'd vote for Bernie Sanders. I think, you know, he really is bringing a lot of important ideas into this race that we're not going to hear from Hillary Clinton. But I'm just wondering how long it can stay significant. And even granting all that Saul Alinsky grassroots stuff, I mean, I don't know. I don't know how long he can really kind of stay on the radar screen in a way that's going to be meaningful.
Well, I think it also raises the question of whether traditional debates are outdated and whether we need a different approach and a different style so that people can engage.
They should come on public radio talk shows more often.
I agree.
I'm just saying.
I think there should be live call-in on public radio, preferably WNPR.
Thank you.
If all the candidates could come. Because it removes that kind of well-polished veneer of all your practice talking points. You can have a debate in Florida where the incumbent doesn't want to come on stage because his opponent has a fan and he says that's an electronic aid. So Americans tap out of that. And as Bill said, with 16 candidates, there's nothing substantive that will come out of that debate. Do it as, you know, social media, online hangout, come on public radio, but we have to have a different way of engaging people so that we can have those interesting discussions.
Very short, Bill.
And just again, it's bracketing the horse race stuff right now is I think the smartest way to approach this. Right now, it's up to over 40% of the Democratic Party that wants an alternative to Clinton, and if they come to that debate demanding a real fight over a platform. Most people who come with a third or more of the convention for the last 30 years only wanted to give a speech, Gary Hart, Ted Kennedy, Jesse Jackson. If these people come and they want to change the direction of the party, it'll be the best convention in 50 years.
We're talking with Bill Curry. He's our political analyst, and he's also a columnist for Salon.com. Kalilah Brown-Dean is an associate professor of political science at Quinnipiac University. Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. When we come back, we'll talk about some of the big issues facing America right now. On one hand, a foreign policy issue, this treaty with Iran. On the other hand, it's race and policing, something we talked about on our program recently. I will just say we got a tweet from our friend Dan Haar about the anger that you talked about, Bill. He says, the anger is simple. It's just another sign of the American empire collapsing. This is something that Dan has said to us before. Thank you so much, Dan. Keep those tweets coming at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. It's The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. We've been talking national politics with Bill Curry, Kalilah Brown-Dean, and our own Colin McEnroe, who, of course, hosts The Colin McEnroe Show. What's happening at 1 o'clock today in your show, Colin?
This is big.
It's comedy day.
This is big.
It's comedy day. And unlike covering the presidential race, this is intentional comedy. So Martin Short, a comedy performance giant, is joining us. Also, one of the key writers from Seinfeld, the guy who came up with shrinkage and yada yada and a bunch of other things really kind of have worked their way into the American, you know, lexicography, into the canon. He will be with us too. So
my goodness, so that is a jam packed show. I can't believe Martin Short. Oh my goodness, one of my heroes. So that'll be fun this afternoon at 1 o'clock on the Colin McEnroe Show. We also want to thank the folks from CTN, the Connecticut Network, who are here taping today's program for future broadcast.
I don't know if you've seen Chase Rogers' Deaf Comedy Jam, which is one of their new shows. It's great. I recommend it.
Check out CTN.
Martin Short would bring so much to this presidential race.
It's available on cable systems everywhere. I want to get to, a few issues here. And it's really a conversation about what it is we should be talking about right now in America in 2015. And there's a lot to talk about. Bill, when we were trading emails beforehand, you say that, you know, despite what we've been talking about, some of the intemperate remarks that have been said about the Iran nuclear treaty, the actual substantive parts of this deal are very, very important. You think this is one of the really important things that we should be discussing right now in America?
Yeah, I do. I mean, as I wrote last Sunday, I think that public corruption is the issue driving the election. But then you always step back and say, well, what should be at the center of the public debate as well? And I honestly believe the Iran treaty ranks with Obamacare as the possibly among the two most important pieces of Obama's legacy. It is not out of the woods. Even in our own Connecticut delegation, most Democrats have barely a Democrat across the country has said yet how they're going to vote. Partly they want to demonstrate that unlike the Republicans, they're reading the text before they reach a conclusion. Partly they have difficult politics. But by my own very amateur count, it's actually – this is up in the air. This is not a settled question. All the people who told us that declaring – that we could export democracy by force of arms, that we could go into the Middle East, invade Iraq and set up a democratic caliphate that would rule for 1,000 years, have been proven so utterly and miserably wrong. It is – true, as you watch this debate, that we have to be careful about about our opponents. The Iranians are like anybody else we're in disagreement with may well look to cheat. We need good monitoring. But what's really happening here is that there's a chance that the rule of law and the peaceful negotiation of two people very much at odds might in fact bring the kind of transformation in the Middle East that the force of arms never brought. And all the people who gave us the Iraq War are making two huge claims about this. One is that we can go on with the sanctions regime if we fail, and two, that it won't necessarily lead to war to get it out. They're both wrong. I pray that within my own party, every person – and it would be great if we had – if political parties in America were really political parties, there would be a grassroots effort to put this issue at the center of the debate. It's the best chance at Middle East, peace we've seen in my lifetime.
But it is a debate, and it will be a debate in Congress. And, I mean, as much as many of us had hoped for more congressional oversight of, say, the several wars that we've waged over the course of the last 20 years, here Congress will have oversight over this deal. And it could, in very real terms, Bill, come down to some partisan politics, but actually be a debate that does not end up on the side of the president and does not end up on the side of this deal moving forward. Secretary of State John Kerry keeps saying, well, that'll tell everyone that there's 535 secretaries of state. But that is indeed part of what the balance of powers is all about. It's a little bit.
Although it's not a treaty, we're not promising to do things for them out of this. The sanctions weren't a treaty. This isn't a treaty. This is an international global suspension of sanctions based upon a set of things that Iran's going to do. So under our Constitution requires a declaration of war. For yet again, we're in another war now against ISIS, and the Congress, which is always complaining that Obama is a tyrant, won't even come to work and have a debate about whether this is a sensible thing. We are actually backing our way into another war at the same time because they're playing to their base and because they're so profoundly ignorant of the underlying issues. As I sat and listened yesterday for 2 hours of Kerry's interrogation, I couldn't help but reach that conclusion. They are jeopardizing the one chance we have. If we walk away from this, not only will China and Russia walk away, so will France, so will Germany. There will be no more sanctions. And the only option left on the table is the one that Bibi Netanyahu is secretly for, which is a military option. And it's the worst possible option. Not only do we have a better chance of Iran not developing a nuclear weapon with this treaty than without it, but if you saw all the celebrations in the street in Tehran when this was announced – if you've seen all the reporters from all sides who come back and report about what they feel the real public opinion is, this is a chance. This is a chance to alter the tone and to alter the fundamental dynamics of the Middle East for the first time in ages.
Kalila?
Bill talked a lot about the Constitution and the rule of law, and I think that's important. But I think we also have to look at what's going on within the United States. And when we have the continued and blatant denial of Americans' First, Fifth, Fourth, Eighth, and 14th Amendment rights, when we talk about racial disparities and excessive force by police officers and law enforcement, then we have to take a step back. And that's the conversation that I'm disappointed that more Americans are not having. If we fought the Iraq War to bring democracy and fairness, what happens when we don't have that here at home? So whether we're talking about the, you know, high number of women that are now dying within police custody, you have both Democrats and Republicans talking about comprehensive criminal justice reform. No one has mentioned the disproportionate impact of these policies on women, particularly women of color. And so when you look at the fact that so many people are going into Americans' prisons, which means that more children are ending up in foster care, These are the conversations that we need to have. It is connected to every essential American value, whether we're talking about economic prosperity, we're talking about fairness, we're talking about how young people view themselves in this country. That's the conversation we all should have, and not just African Americans, not just people directly affected.
And maybe we shouldn't have expected it to be a big part of the conversation amongst the 16 presidential candidates on the Republican side. Although I will say, so far, Kalila, that a really important differentiator for one of them might be the ability to talk in some substantive way about these very same issues. But similarly, on the Democratic side, do you see Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders having this conversation about race in America and policing in America? I guess over the course of the next year, we may have a whole bunch of conversation about whether or not we've ceded too much to Iran because it's an easy talking point on the left or on the right. I don't know how much in the political realm we're going to be talking about this issue that you bring up.
I think that we as a country are on the cusp of deciding our future on these issues. When you talk about the president saying we need to restore Pell Grants so that people in prison have an opportunity to earn an education and can actually get a job that can sustain them once they are released. When you have Hillary Clinton saying, look, I realize that the policies my husband promoted in the 90s led to many of the disparities that we have. But then you have a gathering of progressives at Netroots Nation where demonstrators say, look, Martin O'Malley, look, Bernie Sanders, if you don't talk about the Black Lives Matter movement and not just as an instance, then you too are doing damage. So I think we see that sort of grassroots organizing that, you know, I always tell my students is even more important than formal electoral participation. But there has to be, again, a conversation. We don't have to agree. But when these things happen, there's immediate, oh, well, you just want to condemn law enforcement or you just want to excuse bad behavior. And what people are saying is, how do we keep ourselves safe? How do we keep our officers safe if we can't at least address these things in a proactive manner and not always be so reactionary in what we do?
So, yeah, first of all, you're both right. I mean, these are both huge issues, but in different ways. And so just go back to the Iran thing for a quick second. It is it's such a good deal that it's kind of hard to imagine how it could be a better deal. I mean, it's hard to imagine what the critique would be. I mean, should we also have gotten them to change the name from Iran to the Yard Goats, eliminate a consonant from Farsi? I mean, what do you want to come out of this? So, I mean, it also sort of answers the question, you know, has Joe Lieberman completely disappeared from the scene or is there one last thing he can screw up? Apparently, he's still with us. But I mean, but I do think – so I think this is really, really important in all the ways that Bill says. I just completely agree with that. However, here's the other thing that I think. As a political consideration, as a consideration affecting the race, the ultimate race for president, the election in November of 2016, I actually think what happens in the summer of 2015, for the most part, just to look backward at our previous conversation, isn't that important. I think it's a great time to make your mistakes, say your dumb thing. You know, so Jeb Bush says Americans aren't working hard enough or whatever. That was a really stupid thing to say, but he said it in the summer of 2015. He can get past it. You can get past a lot of these things. I think the one thing that will survive out of this summer that will be important a year from now is some version of hashtag Black Lives Matter. I feel that's the way in which the American political narrative has been transformed in the last 9 months in a way that I would not have predicted was possible. And yeah, I don't think Sanders and O'Malley seem very ready for that, which is, I mean, that's quite a condemnation. I mean, they should be faster on their feet with that one. They should be ready. Probably if Clinton had been there for that, she would have had a better answer. But to me, that's the change. The conversation we're having right now, the reckoning we're having right now in America about race is, to me, the transformative thing that's happening right now. And it will persist. It will endure. Candidates who don't deal with it well probably won't do very well in the fall.
But will – I guess my question to Kalila, and I'll ask to you, will we actually have candidates who will grapple with it? It will be something we'll talk about. It will be something that Americans will increasingly grapple with. But the question is, will our politicians, will politics actually do anything about this whatsoever? It is seemingly the most important thing we need to talk about and something that doesn't make the top 10 list in a lot of ways.
I think you sort of have your answer already in the sense, and we've talked about this, I think, on previous shows. Every single Republican candidate of any substance now has some kind of criminal justice reform component to his campaign, his or her campaign. Now, that – That's not really necessarily addressing race at the level of Black Lives Matter, but it's a suggestion to me that these are issues that you will not easily be able to walk away from. Mass incarceration is essentially an issue about race. You know, all these things are essentially issues about race. And I think that it is so top of mind right now. It's such a big story in so many different ways. I don't see how a candidate can walk away from it.
Bill?
I agree with Colin about the depth of the change. I actually wrote about this a couple of weeks ago in my Salon column. The Republicans will do what they can to exploit it, and the Democrats will do what they can to avoid it. They're so afraid of the tag of identity politics. They so want to frame this in a different way. Of all the tapes, of all the depressing videos we've had to watch of white on black death, of white law enforcement officers killing unarmed black citizens. The Sandra Bland tape is the most upsetting to me. And it is so the conduct of that officer, and to read a day or two later he was on some kind of administrative reassignment, it was such a horrific a blow just to anyone, any sensitive person. I'm not sure how much the country's watching this particular one. I'm not sure how much the white community, there's this point of exhaustion. We've watched so many of these one after another for years. And I worry that there's a kind of digging in on the part of some white voters, in fact. I hope that's not the case. But the ongoing, you know, the demography of this, the long-term picture of it, there's no question. Social liberalism is becoming part of the reigning American political consensus. That's really good news. Whether we can make this – whether we can face up to issues like this, that woman changed lanes and ended up a suicide in jail, that she spent 3 days in jail for a change of lanes without a signal, I'm again, as with some of the remarks, I'm just shocked that the entire country is not in an insurrection over this. This is vile. It is vile that this could happen in this country today.
But it takes – and Kalila, you and I have talked about this on this program before. But I think it takes a different sort of reckoning than the one that happens on news shows or in the newspapers or even sometimes at the dinner table. At the heart of this is a notion that white America just doesn't get now, nor will ever get, the things that black America has had to deal with for hundreds of years and will have to deal with in the future. That doesn't transform in a summertime. It doesn't transform over 1 year after Ferguson. And I don't know how long it takes. And I don't know if politics is even the place to have a conversation. That feels to me like that's an internal sitting by yourself thinking about it conversation. That's a hard one to have in America.
Right. Politics is the afterthought to this. You know, think about what was going on the beginning of this summer, all the debates about the Confederate flag and this reverence for the past and for history. And yet what we often tell African Americans and those who feel victimized is get over that history, get over that past.
You get over yours.
Right. So let me keep mine. You get over yours. And so what people are saying is if we cannot fundamentally address how is it that an unarmed man at the University of Cincinnati gets pulled over in a traffic stop and dies with his face blown off by a campus cop. Right? How do you tell kids to stay safe if we say, look, you have the right to ask questions. You have the right to not just accept things. You may end up dead in a cell, but that's your First Amendment right. That is something that politics alone cannot address. That is an internal conversation. But again, conversation is what's needed.
A last thought on this call before we break?
Yeah, I mean, I think I do think it's first of all, yes, it will be a polarizing conversation. It's not going to be a consensus conversation. So the people who are dug in on the sort of, you know, the white side of this, as Bill says, they're going to dig in even harder. It's not going to be a pretty conversation, but we're going to have a more open and honest conversation in which each side's really put their markers down. And I think it's really important. I mean, this country has just never had the kind of reckoning about slavery that, you know, Germany had about Nazism or that South Africa had about apartheid. We never did it. And we're almost kind of doing it now. And that's kind of exciting.
We're talking in the wheelhouse today with our own Colin McEnroe, Kalila Brown-Dean from Quinnipiac University, Bill Curry, who writes a column on politics for Salon.com. When we come back, we're going to be focusing on a local race in Hartford that we've been speaking a lot about, but it's actually taken an interesting turn, and race is a part of this conversation. That's coming up next in the Wheelhouse here on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, it's the middle of summertime. Beachgoers around our state and region are flocking to the hot, sandy shores. What could be better? Actually, there are higher fees at some beaches, some high bacteria counts, long recovery from recent storms. We'll examine the state of Connecticut's beaches on the next Where We Live. Colin and I are laughing because in our news meeting, one of our producers brought up this really fun idea to go to the beach and talk about our state parks. And I'm
I think Josh had like Annette Funicello and Frankie Avalon in mind. Wow. And you
talking about Debbie Downer.
You crushed that spot.
I really wanted to do a program about high bacteria levels. And so that's what we're going to be talking about.
Who wouldn't, really, when you
tomorrow,
think about it?
Where We Live. We're going to talk about fun stuff at the beach, too. I promise. Bring your flip-flops. That's tomorrow's Where We Live. Today, it's The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. We're joined today by Bill Curry, who writes a column for Salon.com and is also our Democratic political analyst, associate professor of political science at Quinnipiac University, Dr. Kalila Brown-Dean, and Colin McEnroe, who's the host of The Colin McEnroe Show here on WNPR. So, Colin, we're going to talk a little bit about local politics once again, and it's back to the city of Hartford. We spent some time talking about it last week, but it was in a preview of a convention, a meeting of the Democratic Town Committee in Hartford, which happened this Monday night, and there was an awful lot of drama. Let's first hear from some of the voices of the people who are at the center of this. Pedro Segarra, the sitting mayor, talks about what he decided to do, knowing that he was probably not going to get the nomination going in.
I decline the nomination for mayor of the city of Hartford. This fight will go to the streets of Hartford. This fight will be decided by the people of the city of Hartford.
So, and after that, he takes his supporters out of the hall, and they're chanting to the streets in Spanish. Meanwhile, Luke Bronin, who got the nod at this convention meeting. Here's what he had to say.
And what we hear from the residents of Hartford every single day is what we heard resoundingly in this vote tonight, which is that Hartford needs a change.
Okay, so Hartford City politics, Colin, this is important to the state because it's the capital city. It's, of course, a city that has long struggled in many ways, and it has, I think we all think, a lot of possibilities, a lot of hope on the horizon. So here's a kind of a transformative race between a relative newcomer, Luke Bronin, a guy who used to work for Governor Dan Malloy and has some support from that side of the Connecticut Democratic establishment. Meanwhile, Pedro Segarra, a guy who kind of found his way into office and has some support around the city, but certainly is in a fight right now. This race has taken on some interesting overtones in just the last week, I think.
Yeah, I mean, the dumbest thing you can say about Hartford politics is, I know what's going to happen next. and so I'm never going to say that ever again because, I mean, for example, I did not anticipate Mayor Segarra declining the nomination, and I don't think very many people did. I think, you know, there's a couple of different potential narratives here. So one of the narratives, and you're hearing it in coded language and sometimes not so coded language, goes something like this. You know, people of color have been ascendant in this city. It's a majority-minority city. We've taken control. We've got the kind of power that we deserve. And now there is this white minority backed by God knows who that's trying to reassert itself and take control back. So that's and you're going to hear that a lot. And sometimes it's going to be expressed in fairly ugly ways. And not just from the supporters of Pedro Segarra. You'll hear it also from Joella Cruz, who's running an independent candidacy. The other narrative is the city doesn't work right now. You know, this Hartford has a lot of problems that aren't the government's fault or aren't easily controllable by the government. I mean, crime is not necessarily controllable. Decisions by big corporations to leave Hartford, whether it's Bank of America or UTC or something, moving stuff out of Hartford, government can't always control that. But the one thing government can control is government. And government right now in Hartford doesn't work. And we have a strong mayor system, so that means that it's the mayor's fault when government doesn't work. When the fire department has multiple scandals, when there's nepotism running through all the departments, when the public works department is found to be in a state of huge dysfunction, that all sits at the mayor's feet. That's the other narrative, that somebody competent of any color has to come in here and take the reins. And so that's the narrative that Luke Bronin is riding. The other narrative is the one that Segarra is riding.
Yeah, I think, you know, the tone of that nomination speech or him declining the nomination was as if, you know, we're gentrifying City Hall. If we don't allow me to stay in office, City Hall will be gentrified, which means that power will be taken back in the city. But I think what voters need to realize is that gaining office is really a hollow prize without some substantive policy reforms that can improve the material conditions for people in the city. So whether that's education reform, so that the education that children in Hartford receive is not contingent on neighborhood and zip code, those are things that a mayor can have an impact on, whether it's the appointments that he makes to head up that system or seeking innovative ways to do that in partnership. That's important. And I don't think that the people, voters, really care necessarily about the demographic makeup of the person representing them as long as that person is delivering substance. And so that's what should be important here.
I think you maybe could have stopped over after just hollow prize, though. In some ways, getting that job really is just that, because it's a job that after you have it, you might not necessarily want it. What do you make of all this, Bill?
Two things. First of all, I would just it pains me to comment on this, but number one, some of the ethnic politics is about a competitive feeling that you find in many cities between Hispanics and African Americans. African Americans who often see one group after another, the grocery stores get bought by another ethnic group, but it's never the people who live in the neighborhood, and so there's been a sort of simmering rivalry there. And that has played into many – in all of our cities, especially Hartford, lots of elections. I agree that with what Colin said. There's a simple question of competency here. To say that Hartford's had a long, bad string here is important. But I really think that Kalila was hitting on something very important. And let me just say quickly that, one, this question of whether this meritocracy – this sort of elite meritocracy that has absolute control of the Democratic Party at the highest levels is out of touch with its own base. Forget all the tribal stuff. Forget all the ethnic stuff. Just put it aside. The governor's own policies here, he ran on property tax reform when he first ran and then didn't really want to hear about it after that. He went for a corporate-backed education reform that set off an insurrection in Bridgeport and other communities around the state where people didn't want it. We have issues like insurance discrimination, where you have to take on the big insurers when the crime rates go down, the insurance rates never go down with them. There are a whole set of structural issues: access to capital, property tax, educational policy, where that elite of the Democratic Party actually hasn't been in touch, in my opinion, with either the systemic needs of cities like Hartford or with the preferences and values of the Democratic base, especially in cities. And so it would behoove the both candidates here, but especially Mr. Brodin, to put on the table how much of that he's for. I agree on the police stuff and fixing the Hartford Police Department is the single most important thing that could happen to help that city. But all these structural issues have to be faced or we will never fix our cities. The fact that we have one of the worst records in the country on this in this state, on property tax reform and everything I've mentioned, is the reason we have the poorest cities in one of the richest states to this day. I'd like to hear more about that.
Yeah, I don't disagree with what Bill's saying about the meritocracy, although I would hate to have it be the case that two people like the Bronins, who are extremely competent, they're very smart, they're both Rhodes Scholars, they've both done these amazing things, and Sarah Bronin's service to the city already is significant, not only in terms of what she's done architecturally with her own property, but being chair of the Zoning Commission, a whole bunch of other things. You'd hate to see that two people like that were discounted or discredited or something because of their credentials, that somehow they're weighed against them. So here they are. They see an opportunity. Maybe they see a vacuum that they're trying to exploit. I mean, I wouldn't completely reject that narrative, but they're here in Hartford.
Yeah. Nobody should be rejected because of their qualifications, their credentials. This isn't about anti-caste. Mm. This is about my point is simply about the philosophy. What is the public vision of the reigning order of the Democratic Party? Is it right for Hartford, and will you do that? There's no question. Who's likely to do this more competently, the present regime or the challenger? Mm-hmm. The challenger. But what's he going to do competently? It's like yes, we can from 2008, but nobody said can what?
And one of the interesting notions, of course, is that of the speeches that Pedro Segarra has made, he talked actually about suburbanites coming from the outside. That this may be a loaded word, but at the same time, building a baseball stadium, hopefully trying to bring in suburbanites, one would think that trying to get people who want to spend money and time and effort in the city is probably a pretty good thing. More to talk about on this over the course of the next few months. I want to thank Bill Curry, who writes a column for Salon.com. Thank you, Bill.
My pleasure.
Thank you also, Kalila Brown-Dean from Quinnipiac University. Thank you so much,
good
Doctor.
To see you.
And thank you, Colin. Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. We often end with something fun. I do want to mark something today. It's the 10th anniversary of the crash on Avon Mountain, which killed a number of people, including a family friend of mine. A lot has changed since then in that part of the state, but I thought a lot of us should take a moment to remember one of the worst single events that ever happened in the state and just think back about our loved ones when they head to work in the morning. This is where we live.